This president campaign is the first to be conducted under the Campaign Financing Act of 1974. That act sets a limit to the contribution that any individual may make to any single campaign. And it also provides federal subsidies, both for the primary and general elections for those candidates who qualify. Born in the days after the Watergate revelations, when it became clear how much many of the major corporations of the United States had violated the law in providing illegal and illicit contributions to the Republican campaign of 1972. This new Campaign Financing Act was designed to eliminate some of the involvement of candidates with special interest groups, presumably to cut down the cost of elections. It would be nice to report that the candidates will spend less money this year. But in point of fact, both President Ford and Governor Carter will spend slightly more money than Senator McGovern spent 4 years ago. What has been eliminated is the kind of paranoid extravagance which was exhibited in Mr. Nixon's campaign. What has been avoided is the need for candidates to go hat in hand to individuals and to groups seeking the money, a major part of the money with which they will need to run a campaign. And presumably this will reduce the obligations of candidates to these groups. That's not yet proven. These special interest groups still have their private jets and their hunting lodges. And they can still, many of them, turn out large number of votes. As a matter of fact, an inordinate amount of money still in this campaign has come from special interest groups. In the first 9 months of 1976, the Political Action Committee of the American Medical Association has already given over $905,000 to various candidates. And COPE, the Committee on Political Education of the AFL-CIO, has spent $750,000 in direct subsidization of individual candidates and nearly $2 million in a massive voter registration drive in those areas and among those groups who could be counted to vote for candidates of whom the big labor approves. Often the reforms of 1 year work themselves out in strange ways. It is clear that the new federal subsidy has made it necessary for canvassers to be in the field before candidates, to make it sure that enough individual small contributions can be raised in the primary so that a candidate can actually qualify for federal subsidy, which makes it suggest that it is often the paid public relations person who is the first and often the only personal contact between a candidate and a voter. It's also true that the distance between candidates and individuals, even if they represent special interests, has been enlarged. Because when you went to a candidate, to an individual with hat in hand, with a request for funds, you couldn't simply wave to him from a passing limousine. But increasingly, in all ways, the distance has grown between the electorate and the elected, or those who want to be elected. And I think that's rather unfortunate for the long-term health of our society. The Campaign Financing Act of 1974 was designed as a reform act in order to eliminate some of the abuses that had been seen in earlier campaigns. It attacked the money problem. It did not attack the problem of length, of the inordinate length of our campaigns. A primary was held in the state of New Hampshire on the 24th of February of this year, 8 months ago. The final date for qualifying for registering a candidate for that primary was December 25th of 1975, 10 months ago. Governor Carter has been campaigning for the presidency for 18 months. I'm sure he's incredibly tired, bone weary. And I know that most voters are tired not only of Governor Carter, but of all the candidates. I'm sure I'm not the only one who reaches impatiently for his car radio whenever one of the innumerable and insufferable campaign advertisements comes on the air. We've had it with campaign rhetoric and hullabaloo. The inordinate length of the campaign has made for its fuzziness. The election has tended, the campaigns have tended to become frazzled and unraveled and disheveled. Candidates state their major themes early on, in their first speeches and their acceptance speeches. But they're surrounded by a horde of news-hungry media people, because an election as we hold it now is essentially a media event. And the media people cannot feed to their newspapers and to our television news at 7 o'clock the same broad statements over and over again. They want new things, news, hard news. And the candidates and or their advisors have tried to present to them such news, with the result that most Americans have been distracted from the central issues of the campaign. They've forgotten what they were, if they were ever told. And this campaign for the presidency has featured largely irrelevancies, trivial matters, peripheral issues. So much so that somehow we have reduced this campaign to a beauty contest. And most Americans would be hard-pressed to tell you exactly how the two candidates differ on the major issues, the economy, civil rights, welfare, foreign policy, and the like. It's all been said. They've said it, but that what they said was overlaid by this barrage of irrelevancy. For 3 weeks of this campaign, we were told more about the problems of the unborn than of those who are already born. We were filled with the news about the so-called abortion issue. If ever there was a trivial issue for a national campaign, that was it. You recall that a delegation of the National Council of Roman Catholic Bishops visited first with Governor Carter, who in his years of public office has not been known to take a major stand one way or another on the issue. And Governor Carter came out four square against abortion, disapproves of it, suddenly. But the bishops were not satisfied. And 2 weeks later, they visited with President Ford. And President Ford one-upped Governor Carter. He was not only opposed to abortion, but he was in favor of a constitutional amendment which would allow the states the rights to declare abortions illegal within their boundaries. Now, nearly over a quarter century of public office, President Ford has never favored such a constitutional amendment nor taken a strong stand on the issue. Both men come from the heartland of Protestantism, where family planning and abortion are not seen as major sins. Abortion news filled our headlines, and then when the National Council of Bishops released the report of these two meetings with the clear indication that Catholics should take into serious consideration President Ford's stronger statement against abortion than Governor Carter's, not only did they manage to anger family planning groups and women's groups of all kinds and civil libertarian groups and many of us who stand on the other side of the issue, but they managed to anger a vast number of Roman Catholics who are determined that no single issue, and certainly campaign rhetoric about no single issue, shall determine their vote. With the result that there was a hullabaloo even within the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, charge and countercharge, denial and denials of denials, And the papers were filled with all of this, and somehow we forgot the economy, and we forgot detente, and we forgot all the other issues of the campaign. It's gone that way. The major issues of this campaign have been the racist humor of Secretary Butts, the interview that Governor Carter gave to a raunchy magazine, those kinds of things. And in the process, unfortunately, the issues were lost. In the process, the candidates lost sight of the issues, not only we. And they began to think that all that was necessary was to find the one issue to which this group or that block of Americans responded and to outbid each other on the issue. In the second of those television non-events, which were called campaign debates, you recall that President Ford made the incredible gaffe of saying that the countries of Eastern Europe were not under Soviet domination. And that night, Governor Carter scored some points by making the observation that it would be hard to tell Hungarian Americans and Polish Americans and Czech Americans that their sometime homelands were not under Soviet domination. Now, the issue might have been left here, and it would have shown that the president was not as careful with his words as he might have been, not as up on foreign policy as we would expect a president to be, and Governor Carter would have scored heavily. But Governor Carter couldn't leave it alone. And suddenly his staff was calling every Turnverein in Sokol Hall looking for an audience in order to resurrect the issues of the early 1950s of the Cold War, making it seem as if it was American policy to roll back Soviet sovereignty, domination, call it what you will, in Eastern Europe. And the staff of President Ford was also calling every nationality hall seeking for booking in order to assure the exiles or the children of exiles that he really did not mean what he had in fact said. Somehow, in all of this, the American people got the message that two candidates were being huckstered to us in the way the Madison Avenue tries to sell us deodorant, soap. The American people got the idea that the two candidates, or at least their staffs, had very little respect for our mentality. But they still believed that we took campaign rhetoric seriously, that really, once you could find a group of so-called hyphenated Americans, Hungarian Americans or Italian Americans or Catholic Americans or Jewish Americans, and you would speak to them of rolling back Soviet domination or of the abortion issue or of Israel, that somehow you were guaranteed their vote provided you could come out a little more strongly than had your opponent. Now, certainly Israel is a major legitimate concern of the American Jewish community. And certainly the Jews of the United States gauge presidential candidates in terms of their long-term support or lack of it, understanding or lack of it of the Middle East and all the issues involved there. And certainly we look to see whether or not these men have surrounded themselves with advisors and groups who are traditionally sympathetic to the Jewish community or not. But none of us are so foolish, however intense our Zionism, our concern with Israel may be, to believe that what they say to us within 90 days of our going into the voting booth has any relevance to what they will do after they are elected and ensconced in the White House. We know enough to discount the President of the United States when he said that his administration moved heaven and earth to undo the worst excesses of the Arab boycott. We saw his minions on the Capitol Hill scurrying around to see to it that the corporate interests and the oil interests had their interests safeguarded. But at the same time, we know that the clear, unequivocal statement of Governor Carter that he would wage economic warfare against the Arab states in order to void the boycott was so much hokum. And when he gets into Washington, the State Department, the Commerce Department, and the Corporation of the United States will descend upon him as they have every right to do. And he will moderate, and he will adjust, and he will in some ways find to compromise and to fudge what he said to us. But unfortunately, as this campaign lengthened and came down towards the wire, both candidates were being sent in more and more to these halls where special interest groups had assembled. And they were speaking more and more to a very narrow range of interests and less to the overarching interests which are of concern to us all. And the campaign got off the track and remains off the track. And when most of us vote Tuesday next, we are not going to be very clear as to why we're voting, because the candidates have not made it clear to us really where they stand. Now, length has had a deleterious effect on this campaign. And so has the Madison Avenue flavor which surrounds it. Madison Avenue has taken over campaigns in the last 20 years or so, maybe 30 years. And the more the professional campaign managers get their hands on campaigns, the greater the distance between those who are campaigning and the electorate. Because these Madison Avenue people are used to the hard sell. You think you can identify a single interest or a single market and gear your advertising to that interest and to that market. And even when they succeed in electing a president, that is, in getting our votes in sufficient numbers to elect a president, they somehow undo the president because they have reduced him and demeaned him sufficiently during the campaign. He really doesn't come in with a clear mandate for those things which he proposes to achieve. When you elect a beauty queen, you're simply electing a person whom you think to have beauty in your particular eye at the moment. You're not saying anything about the quality of her mind or the quality of her person or the quality of her character. And you elect a president on qualities, assumed qualities of personality. You're not electing him for his proposals. You're not electing him for the platform of his party. You're not electing him for the principles which he has enunciated. He'll be the weaker leader for it. This campaign has been a campaign of missed opportunities. It's been a campaign of distance between growing distance between the elected and the electors. Cleveland was visited by both candidates on Thursday of this week. Cleveland went on its work as if neither candidate was in town. We're a community of 2 million people. The Democratic candidate timed his visit here for the lunch hour so that a few secretaries and gawkers might be found at East 6th Street and Euclid. And labor bussed in some of their people from outlying factory areas. 5 hours later, the president found himself in the heart of Cleveland, 53rd and Fleet Street. Most of us don't even know where 53rd and Fleet Street is. And he was there, and because he was promised that there would be 6 shivering little girls dressed up in Czech, Polish, and Hungarian costumes who could present him flowers and some bread and some salt. Both men were determined not to speak to us, the 2 million people of Cleveland, but to create some images which could go out over the television cameras to the country to show that they were busy and active and concerned with Eastern Europe or concerned with the inner city or whatever it may be. And when you watch a candidate's entourage descend, you recognize how nearly impossible it has become for a candidate to meet the people. Helicopters are overhead. Secret Service troops are in town 2 days ahead of time. Halls are swept clean. There are snipers on every parapet. There's a phalanx of Secret Service around the candidates. and a herd, a horde, call it what you will, of media people with the cameras and the photographers and the microphones and the cars just behind, ready to surround the platform as soon as everybody plants himself there. And suddenly there appear the three or four local candidates who want their picture taken with the presidential candidate, and then it's off to the next stop. The microphone hardly works. No one really listens because everyone knows that there's nothing to be said. And the bond which must exist in a democracy because our elected officials must be elected with the consent of the governed, has been weakened, frayed. Because in a sense, we have a sense that we're being manipulated. And that's a tragedy. I had a man tell me the other day that he wasn't going to vote as a form of protest, as a way of saying, you know, you can't buy my vote. You've tried to put me down in this campaign, and I'm not going to play your game, and that's why I'm not voting. And I suspect there's a good bit of that in the feeling out there among the electorate. Because a strange thing happened on the way to November 2nd. The issue ceased to be this candidate or that candidate, what this man stands for or what that man stands for, but we became the issue. More columns and more media coverage was devoted to the so-called apathy of the electorate, our indecisiveness, our indecision, than to the principles and the platforms of the candidates themselves. And all kinds of propositions and explanations were put forward to say why only 71% of us in the United States who are eligible to vote managed to qualify themselves to vote next Tuesday, down 4% from 1972. And that despite massive registration drives, and that despite reforms of the registration rules, which are to a degree hard to conceive. I remember once falling off the registration rolls during the time that I was in the military. And when I came back, I had to find my way all the way downtown to the Board of Elections 6 months before the election in order to qualify myself for the next general election. In Cuyahoga County this summer and fall, there were 280 places, 280 local neighborhood places where people could go and could register. And they could register up to a fortnight before the campaign itself. And yet only 71% of the people who could qualify to vote in the United States are actually eligible to vote because they've registered. And you may recall that at our first Friday of this year, George Gallup Jr. suggested from this pulpit that this may be the first election in the 20th century in which less than half of those who have the right to cast a ballot will in fact cast that ballot. I suspect he'll be wrong. There has been a growth of interest in voting the last several weeks. But clearly, apathy and indifference and indecisiveness have been part of the ethos of the American electorate these last weeks and months. And the question that the pundits asked was why? Why were we having so much trouble making up our minds? One popular explanation had to do with Watergate. That long list of scandals, crimes, which have affected our elected leaders in Washington in the last 4 years, beginning with Watergate and continuing right down to the latest scandal involving bribes paid directly by the government of the Republic of South Korea. There's been very little humor in this campaign, and the only good story I've really heard is a Watergate kind of story. It involves a group of school children who were taken to visit the Senate of the United States, and they arrived shortly before the Senate convened, and they had a guide. And as the senators were coming in, and they suddenly saw a man rather formally garbed coming from behind the rostrum and approaching the podium and the microphone, and one of the students asked the guide, "Who is this man?" And he was told, "That's the chaplain of the Senate." And the youngster said, "Well, what does he do? Does he pray for the Senate?" And the response was, "Well, he comes here every morning, and he looks out at the senators, and he prays for the country." There is a growing cynicism or skepticism about the honesty of elected officials. But I suspect that that cynicism and skepticism has always been part of the American ethos. We're not romantics. Elections have been bought, you know, throughout our history. There's been bribery, there's been corruption. We are not children who believe in the saintliness of mankind. Well, another popular explanation of our indecision or our apathy might be called the twiddly-dee and twiddly-dum syndrome. This has two parts to it. One line of argument says the two parties put up two rather indifferent men, men who lack charisma or luster or great skill, certainly great appeal, and essentially we're having trouble choosing between two pieces of shoddy goods. Well, I don't know. As I look back on the candidates we've had, there have not been many who've been very much better. Another part of that explanation, which is favored by those who argue that there needs to be a radical reconstruction of the political order, suggests that what we have essentially are two candidates of adequate talent, but who essentially represent parties that represent the same interests. That America is governed by big business and big labor and a number of other groups, and that these groups control the major parties, and the parties put up men with slightly differing views, but essentially the same view. And proof, if proof there be for this position, is developed from the idea, from the fact, that the younger the voter, the less likely that person is to vote. And the assumption is that these are the people who are the most idealistic, the people who are the most disenchanted with the way we go about the business of governing themselves. They don't want to be part of the system. Well, it's a fact of our history that as long as there has been voting in the United States, there's been an inverse ratio in the percentage between voters between one's age or one's youth and the vote. That is, the younger the person in every election, the less likely he was to vote. That's not a new phenomenon. And I suspect, I believe, that one of the great strengths of our American system, one of the facts which has allowed us to develop pragmatically rather than to break up into divisive ideologies, has been the fact that we have a broad consensus, an extreme on the left, an extreme on the right, but essentially a very, very large middle, and that the party system has allowed the middle to find candidates of slightly or significantly, in some issues, differing positions, and that the in-party has been willing, if outvoted, to relinquish office without riot or putsch or rebellion or revolution, because everyone could be assured that America would evolve and reform rather than move ahead by frantic, frenetic fits and starts. No, I think that the explanation for the apathy of our electorate is the fact that both candidates and both parties misread us and misunderstood us and put us down. I sense in America a great willingness to come together for common purpose. The giddy days of prosperity of the 50s and the giddy days of messianic conviction of the 60s are behind us. We know we face many problems crying out for reform, for change, for solutions, if there be solutions. We know we're going to have to tighten our belt. We're going to have to do things differently. We know that we cannot be as careless with the national resource. We know that there are responsibilities as well as rights. We know that we cannot remake the world overnight. Those perceptions have come home to the American people. Some wrote about a sourness in America. I don't sense it. I sense a new devotion, new dedication, a new concern, new sobriety. And neither candidate managed to speak to these new feelings, to this new consensus, to this new seriousness. They tried in old fashion to outbid each other when we were looking for people who would say honestly to us, either I don't know, or not less taxes, but more in order to achieve the things which you're talking about achieving, or more concern with human welfare and more concern with the economy, both at a cost, recognize it. Neither candidate, I think, was willing to face head on the real, deep, profound concerns and crises which face America and which will face America in the future. They tried to con us, and we're too savvy. They tried to put us down when we should have been brought up and lifted up, and the issues lifted up before us. Great opportunity was lost in this campaign by both candidates. There was to be a great national debate. Two men were given nearly 5 hours to speak to the American people and to speak to the issues which confront the American people. But unfortunately, the so-called great debates were rigidly organized. There were minimal time allowed for each question. It was organized as a press conference, not a discussion or a debate. The questions were fired from here or there, and each question, significant or insignificant, was given the same amount of time for an answer. And instead of the debate going on between the two men and the major issues being gone over again and again, questions raised, answers raised, charges raised, issues raised, with a give and take, in which a process in which we could see both the quality of the mind of each candidate and the reasoning, the way in which the man goes about working out his answers. What we got instead were questions, 3-minute answers, which had been carefully programmed by the lackeys and the minions and the experts who do this kind of programming for the major candidates, so much so that I had the sense that all that was happening was we had before us 2 roller pianos. And every time a question was answered, the proper disc was put in and it began to spin. You could see the man reading the answer. And then the answer from over here, or the rebuttal, was another disc. And the discs weren't touching. The music wasn't in the same key. We really didn't have discussion. There was no growth of perception. There was no insight. All we had was proof that both men are quick studies. They're good memorizers. They can assimilate quite an amount of fact. And both were eager to do nothing which would reveal themselves to be as human as we are. You remember those famous 30 minutes standing there in correct silence? That's not what people do. People talk. And people make mistakes when they talk. Mistakes of grammar. Mistakes of fact sometimes. But that kind of conversation is human, and we would have responded to it. There was no humor in this campaign. There was no humanity in this campaign. What there was 2 things called candidates who are being professionally sold to the American people. And both men, I believe, to be better than the image that they were allowed to project. And that's part of the tragedy of this campaign. Neither man was allowed by his advisors or by the media, by the demands of the media, to project himself as a human being, put his real face forward. I'm going to vote next Tuesday. I'm going to vote as a statement, a personal commitment to the political system which is ours. It's a great system. It's a system which works, which guarantees our freedom and a measure of prosperity. And I think it's important that we vote as a statement that we believe in the system. I'm going to vote next Tuesday because I believe that there are significant differences between the candidates, even though they didn't manage to project these to the American people. One man is much more of an interventionist in economic affairs, and one man is much more likely to trust the mechanisms of the marketplace. One man's perceptions begin with human need, and others begin with the needs of business and labor. Each man speaks from a visible, definable political base. And it's not hard to understand the needs and the priorities of that base. I'm going to vote next Tuesday because I believe that either man is as well qualified to be president of the United States as most others who might have been placed before us. I'm not a believer in the leader, capital T, capital L. I believe the greatness of America lies with its people and the whole range of its elected representatives. Most of the problems which face America today are not problems that a leader can solve for us. One of the basic facts about this election, it's one of the first in recent memory, certainly the last 20 or 25 years, where there's not been a single overriding international issue. The problems are essentially domestic, economic, and social, and racial. And here the President of the United States does not rule or even really significantly govern. Public welfare measures, the tax laws, are initiated in and begun by the Congress. It is we, the people, who determine how our communities will be governed and what will be the nature of the relationship between groups and races in the community. It is in the domestic area that the President of the United States is the weakest. It is in the domestic area that the institutions, the bureaucracies, the corporations, the unions are the strongest, and the institution is the most complex. The real power of a president lies in foreign policy. And perhaps the greatest tragedy of this campaign is that neither man has been able to make clear what his foreign policy would be. We have no idea what Mr. Ford's foreign policy will be once his entire foreign policy, Mr. Kissinger, leaves the cabinet. And we have no idea what Governor Ford's foreign policy would be because he really hasn't talked about it. He has no experience, no way of proving him in this area. We have to go on faith that somehow the American interest will be preserved. The men have talked about the domestic issues, the complicated issues. They've not been clear on them, but there are differences. And each of us will, on Tuesday next, vote for the man who most closely approximates the interests and the hopes and the vision, which is ours. But I hope when you go to the polls Tuesday next, and I trust you will go, that you won't go with any heaviness of heart, as if somehow you are being demeaned by entering the poll and voting for either of these men. You're not. They're ordinary, good, garden variety Americans. They both seem to be honest men, both religious men, both men of family, loyalty to their marriages. Children seem to have grown well. They're both men who have some claim on respectability. And no one knows when a man enters the White House whether he will meet the challenges which will be his. No man was ever elected to the White House with greater preparation or greater intellectual ability than Woodrow Wilson. He was unequal to many of the challenges. No man was ever elected to the White House with less training for this kind of administration and less intellectual ability than Harry Truman. And he was equal to many of those challenges. When you elect a person, you never know. You know exactly how the mix of his personal qualities will come down when the fire is on the stove and the fat's on the fire. And that's why on Tuesday next, I'm going to vote and I'm going to pray. Amen.